welcome to Pints with Treebeard. My name is Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho. And today I have the pleasure of being joined by a giant among men, Jameson Winter. Jameson, tell us more about yourself.
Yes, I'm Jameson, and I'm the dean of the upper school at Augustine School in Jackson, Tennessee. So, Josh, what are we talking about today?
So we're hitting another Lord of the Rings episode. So periodically we have taken to attending to Lord of the Rings. Particularly, we have been looking at character studies, which, I don't know, I've had a lot of fun with. And today we're taking the characters of Merry and Pippin into our sights and seeing what we can understand not only about Tolkien's work, but also about the Christian life and parenting and being a good dad from the characters of Merry and Pippin. So maybe I'll toss it to you, sir, and this may be more of a Josh Interviews Jameson style episode because you get to teach Lord of the Rings and thus stew on this stuff on a daily basis. But my question is, why did there have to be four hobbits, right? Because you got Frodo, you got Sam, we kind of understand how they function in the story. But then you've also got Merry and Pippin, but you don't have Fatty Bulger, right? There could have been five hobbits. Turns out there's only four. So why do there need to be four hobbits? What is Tolkien doing with Merry and Pippin? Why do they need to be there? What's going on?
Yeah, well, I'll start by saying I'm not totally convinced and could be convinced that there have to be four specifically, that that number is somehow special to what Tolkien is doing.
I have a whole system of thought that maps them onto the four Gospels, so if you're going to ruin this for me.
No, that's fine. I'll be convinced. I'm happy to be convinced. I'm just not, I don't have that kind of framework in my mind, I guess, in terms of why there have to be four specifically. Because, look, maybe Fatty Bulger's the Book of Acts. I don't know.
Oh, man!
Yeah, I thought I'd throw that in there for you. But no, I'm not sure. There are obviously, you're going to read meaning into the fact that there are four hobbits, just like you would read meaning into the idea of three hobbits, or, for instance, Frodo, Sam, and Gollum at the end of the story, right? That you have this relation of three distinct beings, and so you find particular things about each of them and how they represent different triads. And so it makes sense that the four hobbits would be a kind of quartet, either tied to the Gospels or any other set of four things. And that's, in some ways, maybe apart from Lord of the Rings, because was it Twain who said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes? Is that right?
No, that was, it's on the tip of my tongue, Engels. It was Engels.
Okay. So yeah, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes, right? That idea that we don't escape the biggest story. And so anything that Tolkien is putting into the Lord of the Rings comes from reality. And it reflects reality in some ways. And that's true in ways that he clearly intends. And it's also true in ways that he didn't intend at the time and maybe realized after the fact. Or maybe he never realized. And we realize now as readers, oh, hey, this really clearly kind of embodies this element of reality in the story, whether he knew it or not, because he's drawing on God's story. He's taking subsets and smaller pieces of God's story and using that to create. And not just because he's a Christian, that certainly amplifies what he's doing, but because he's a person and he's made in God's image and he lives in God's world, and that's inescapable. So that's true of any story. And it's particularly true maybe when you have a Christian writing a story because they have more revelation that they're working with and drawing from. So not to cast any kind of doubt on your connection to the Gospels, and maybe we can do an episode on that and I'll interview you. But I don't have a framework like that, why there have to be four specifically. I do think there need to be several hobbits because they're all performing different functions for the story. And that's clear, obviously, with Frodo. He's the ring bearer. There's way too much to go into there, so I won't even start. It's true with Sam as his servant and as his friend. So there's a uniqueness between their connection, even amongst the four hobbits. And interestingly, that doesn't exactly start as true in terms of friendship. Frodo is actually closer to Merry than anyone. And yet over the journey, because Sam has taken an oath to stay with him, he becomes intimately woven together with the character of Sam. And they are so essential for one another. So we can handle the two of them in a separate episode or a separate series of episodes, frankly. But Merry and Pippin really do go together, and I think they are revealing something about, if I can put it this way, maybe hobbits at large, right? What needs to happen to all of the hobbits? Because Frodo has a unique journey. Sam has a unique journey. But Merry and Pippin are kind of, I think, more representative of the corporate body of hobbits and what needs to happen to them as a society, which we'll get to in just a second. But I think that's basically Tolkien's thesis, is bringing the hobbits into the world.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that before. But you actually can't see Frodo and Sam's hobbitness because they are so wrapped up in the quest. And you can only see Frodo as ring bearer and Sam as his, you know, his aide. So you actually can't see them as hobbits. So that's really interesting. You need Merry and Pippin to remind us what hobbits are like. That's really good.
Yes, which I think is the thesis of the story. And I emphasize this on day one of class with my students. We read the prologue, and we don't read the prologue, actually. We read the first paragraph of the prologue, and we talk about a lot of things and how Tolkien is setting up the story. So this is the famous section concerning hobbits. And the first sentence of the book is, "This book is largely concerned with hobbits, and from its pages, a reader may discover much of their character and a little of their history." And we just stop there and talk for like 10 minutes about, okay, what is he saying? He's telling you, this is the author telling you what he's writing about and why he's writing it. You don't have to guess. There's no interpretation needed. And there are other things that the book addresses. Obviously, there's deeper meaning and all kinds of symbols and motifs that you can trace out. But fundamentally, this is a book about hobbits. It's a book that wants to show you some of their history and much of their character. And that's, I think, the key. That's the emphasis. So the events even of Frodo destroying the ring and them coming back and scouring the Shire, that's like the plot side of things is secondary to Tolkien. He wants to show you the character of hobbits because I think ultimately he's using hobbits as a kind of window into humanity and how we mature into wisdom and godliness with greater revelation and need to, I guess, in some sense, press ourselves and impress ourselves both individually and corporately to live in God's world in his ways.
Right, because when you read Lord of the Rings, you're supposed to admire Gandalf and Aragorn and Elrond and etc., but you're not supposed to identify with them. You're supposed to identify with the hobbits. It's their eyes that you're looking through. They are who you're supposed to say, ah, yes, that's, I'm like that. And thus, as they change over the course of the story, so you change over the course of the story. Interesting.
Yeah, and Tolkien does this in so many amazing ways. It's what shows his excellence as a writer and just his ability to think in literary motifs and themes and structures that kind of subvert, not subvert in a, I actually don't like that word in terms of like telling stories because people try to subvert your expectations and they think that makes a good story if they can give you something unexpected. But he subverts your defenses as the reader. And he helps you to understand something without realizing that that's what he's doing. So he places you almost always in the perspective of the hobbits, who know the least about the world, who know the least about the histories and the peoples that they're meeting and the places that they're going. And there are times where you maybe shift perspective a little bit. But I heard somebody either write about this or talk about this, I can't remember which, years ago, but it's that Tolkien always keeps you in the perspective of the person who knows the least about what's going on. Even if he's telling you some of the thoughts of Gandalf or the mind of Aragorn or how they're processing things or why they're doing things, he keeps you in that perspective so that you're reading about things like the cats of Queen Beruthiel, or you're hearing little glimpses into this, the story of Beren and Lúthien. And you as a reader have no idea what those things are. And Tolkien doesn't bother to explain them. Importantly, not because they don't have explanations. Right, he has a whole 12-volume set of notes that his son compiled called Histories of Middle-earth that dive deeply into those stories. And he gives you little tastes because like that's what he loved, creating this whole world. But he intentionally only gives you little tastes and doesn't explain it because that's not the point. The point is not for you to geek out and understand Middle-earth completely. If you want to do that as much as possible, go read Histories of Middle-earth. The point is to focus on the hobbits and their change and their maturing.
which is why, as much as I adore the Silmarillion, it was very formative, it doesn't have the same grip. It doesn't have the same appeal because it's not written in that same manner. It doesn't draw you in the same way, as much as I love it. Question for you. In what way is telling the story from the perspective of hobbits similar to, say, another prominent Christian fantasy author telling a story from a perspective from the perspective of children?
Well, first, let me just not come to the defense of the Silmarillion, because I know you're not attacking it, but let me just state my piece here, which is that I love the Silmarillion, I think particularly because it changes its tone. And I don't, you know, we've gone back and forth on that a little bit. I don't want to set the two against one another, but one of the important things about the Silmarillion is that it is a myth, right? It is, and Lord of the Rings is as well. It's a fairy story. It's mythological in many ways, but it's actually a mythological history of Tolkien's world. And I find that particularly compelling, but you're right, for totally other reasons. The reasons that the Silmarillion is compelling and engaging to me as a reader are very fundamentally different in most ways, not every way, but in most ways, with the reasons that Lord of the Rings is so compelling.
We should definitely do a Silmarillion episode where I get to play devil's advocate, because I think that would be really interesting. I would love to probe kind of where you see the Silmarillion fitting into the life of the Christian. I think that'd be a lot of fun, but that's for later.
I agree. That would be great. And I'm happy. Let's say this. Let's both reread it before we do that episode or listen to it or whatever you want to do. I at least will. But back to the question of, you know, your kind of thinly veiled allusion to a certain group of Pevensey children. Or it could be somebody else. I mean, they're like the Wingfeather Saga, maybe. I don't know.
Well, this is a common thing, right? This is a common thing. And it's not a common just because everyone's copying Lewis. It's like he was drawing on, like he's drawing on E. Nesbitt and other things. And also just like human experience. We tell stories from the perspective of children. Why? Right? That's, and so in what ways is Tolkien setting up four hobbits similar to Lewis saying there once were four children? Why do we tell stories from the perspective of children?
Yeah, I think the primary motive there is in some ways going to be revealed in whatever we title this episode, which is going to be something about a coming of age, right? The reason that we tell stories about children is because we want to tell that story of growing in maturity and wisdom, which is what coming of age means. We don't mean literally you got 3 years older. We mean you became wise. You became a man or a woman. And you now know how to walk in the world in a proper way, which is totally different from the, if you think about, for instance, the heroic epics of the Greeks and the Romans. Those are doing something different, but it's not so much coming of age. I mean, I guess maybe you could say, you know, the Aeneid is in some ways Aeneas coming of age, but I think it's much more focused on him founding, obviously, what would become Rome and saving his people and imitating Odysseus and Achilles and others from Homer in those ways. So you have a focus on great men in so many of those stories. And that is a component that, I mean, there, I'm sure that there are other, you know, myths and stories like that that are passed down from Greece and Rome and other places throughout the ancient Western history that talk about children coming of age. But it is, I think, a particularly, at least, if not a Christian focus, it comes from a particularly Christianized segment of the West in history. I mean, you even think about the fairy tales, like the Brothers Grimm and things like this, where you have children who are learning how to walk in the world. And that's what the hobbits are doing. They're learning about the world and how to walk in it as mature hobbits, as a mature, if you want to think about the corporate nature, a mature people, a mature goodly race, right? They're the goodly races of Middle Earth, and hobbits by and large have not participated in the world and not engaged in other things outside the Shire. And this is their coming of age so that they can take their place in the world.
And that draws off of what we talked about with Treebeard. Treebeard doesn't know the hobbits because they haven't come on the stage yet. They're still young. That's really interesting. So you're right. This is also maybe a good place to point out what is lost if you only watch the movies or you're primarily steeped in the movies, which is Frodo's dramatically older than the other three. Not like crazy, crazy older, but he's a good decade older than the other three. And so you don't see, right, the story begins with his coming of age party in some respects. And then he's got to draw the others along to some extent. So that's interesting.
Yeah, and this is something that he begins in The Hobbit, right? Tolkien begins this motif kind of in The Hobbit with Bilbo and him being exposed to the greater world, going on the quest to reclaim the mountain with the dwarves, with the aid of Gandalf, and coming home again. And he is changed. But what was, I think, there clearly in Tolkien as an author and the story he was wanting to tell, and that he was kind of discovering his love for this story, it was there in The Hobbit, but it kind of itself comes to fruition in Lord of the Rings. It comes to maturity in Lord of the Rings, because you're right, you start with the party, and Bilbo is 11-1, and he's aging out. It's time for his story to end in some ways. And Frodo's coming of age, and there's a new story, and it's going to be a deeper story, a richer story, a fuller story. And by the way, it's not just Frodo. It includes Sam and Merry and Pippin. And then it also includes all of the Shire. So you see that, I think, blossoming in The Lord of the Rings in a really wonderful way, because it's always a story that he's been kind of riffing on and kind of playing with, I guess, in The Hobbit. But it really comes to a point in The Lord of the Rings. And I think that's why he begins with Frodo's coming of age in chapter one, and then skips, what, like 17 years, something like that. And by chapter two, you're 17 years later.
Yeah. No, interesting. So I'm interested in your point that the telling the story from the perspective of children is a uniquely Christian thing, because you could push back and say, nah, it's just like a way to appeal to everybody, right? It's the way that your story will have the widest possible appeal. Like, everyone who's probably reading this story has been 7, right? But not everyone has been 27, right? Because theoretically, you could be reading it when you're 25 and you have no idea what it's like to be 27. But if I said it in the words of a 10-year-old or a 7-year-old, everyone can relate because everyone's been that, right? No matter how old you are. So you could just push back and say, nah, it's just a way to establish general appeal. Everyone's been ignorant, so I'm going to tell the story from someone from the perspective of a character who's ignorant so that everyone feels like they can relate. But you dwelt upon or touched upon it being a uniquely Christian thing. Did you have in mind, like, we are, you know, going from the, well, let me just ask you, what did you mean?
Yeah, I think you're probably anticipating some of it at least. And there's maybe more here. I haven't thought very deeply about it being uniquely Christian, this kind of coming of age idea. But it clearly is, I think, at least in this way, that when we tell these stories, or when they are written and told and read in a Christianized culture, and they come out of that culture and that understanding, that broad understanding of reality, what's right, what's wrong, how do we honor God, how do we walk with Him, those sorts of things, they're didactic, first and foremost. They're teaching people how to become Christian. Right? Not by preaching the gospel to them, but how do you live as a Christian in the world that God made? How do you live in a way that honors who God made you to be and what He gave you to do? How do you become a good man or a good woman, in other words, as defined by this Christianized culture that's producing the storyteller, right? So even a pagan who's writing a story about coming of age, if he's in a, you know, say 1600s in England or some other Christianized world, he is going to be telling that story, understanding what a good man or good woman is, because he lives in a broadly Christian culture. And so he's going to be pulling aspects of Christianity into that regardless. But the bigger thing beyond just the didactic nature of it and teaching kids how to do the right thing, don't tell lies, you know, be brave, honor your father and mother, you know, obey your parents, those sorts of things. Beyond just the didactic nature of it, and I don't think that's primarily what Lord of the Rings is doing. I think primarily what Lord of the Rings and other stories like it are doing are showing us that this is us before God, right? We are to come to God as children, and there are depths and riches in His revelation of Himself to seek and to understand and to want to know. And then when you gain more and more of that understanding, when you gain more and more of that wisdom and that fear of the Lord, it needs to affect the way that you live. You can't live as a child anymore. You put away childish things, as Paul says, and you now walk in maturity because you have engaged in God's self-revelation. You've met him, seen him for who he is by his own by his own testimony, and now you're submitting your life to that in a new way. So it's less about just becoming older and becoming a good man or a good woman, although it is that. And I think more uniquely Christian in the sense that you're encountering the transcendent as a finite being. And that is elevating you, at least in some ways, back towards what we were made to be, which is glorified man.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's deep things going on here. So I'm glad that we're kind of teasing it out. I'm not going to go out and say, like, these are things that aren't present in other systems of belief, though probably. But it is interesting to show deep resonance between the idea of telling a story from the perspective of a child who's growing up, and just the coming of age story in general, and the Christian faith, right? Because inherent in the Christian faith is the idea that we're children of God, as you said, but not only children of God, but also that we are being joined to Christ, that we are being transformed, you know, from one degree of glory to another, that we are being built up into the fullness of Christ's image. But also that there's this direction to history, right? That there's this sense in which things are progressing, that we're going somewhere, that it's not cyclical, it's not the great withering, which I think is actually something that there's a tension in Tolkien, because you feel in Tolkien's work this idea that things are passing away, that everything's getting like worse and worse. It's not the way it was back in Numenor. But then you also have this, like, no, actually, it's a new age. It's the fourth age. It's going to be a different thing, but it's going somewhere. And so there's this aspect of hope as the hobbits are growing up, as men are growing up. So this sort of future-directed hopefulness is a Christian thing that's also present in the coming of age story.
That's right. I mean, other false beliefs and false religions and worldviews, they don't have the same kind of eschatological focus and answers that Christ has and that Christ offers us. Your point about being joined to Christ is exactly right. That's something fundamentally unique about Christianity, that we are being joined to God himself and that we are to behold him in all of his glory and we are actually to reign with him over all things. That's totally different from other perspectives on the divine or the world or who humanity is and what we are, what we're meant to be. That's totally different. And so in that way, I think you're exactly right. And then there is this sense, you're right, that you could read the story in a way that the elves are leaving Lothlorien. They're going into the West and we're on the brink of the kingdoms of men finally falling and gasping their last breath and dying. And yet, I think Tolkien is very intentionally doing something different. He is, as you said, coming into a new age, but this is a comedy. It's not a tragedy. Bilbo says at least twice, stories ought to have good endings. And that's Tolkien saying stories ought to have good endings. Like, he's being explicit there, I think, and he's just stepping into the voice of Bilbo saying stories should have good endings. This story, he's implying, is going to have a good ending because history has a good ending. Eschatology is moving in a positive direction, not a negative direction, right? We're moving towards the glory of God and the redemption of all things, even if it looks dark for a time, even if there are those who have to stand in the gap and lay down their lives and sacrifice on the walls of Minas Tirith or by walking into Mordor and back. I guess you don't walk back. He flies out on the eagles, but you get what I mean, right? So there is this kind of eschatological hope that Tolkien bakes into the story that, again, is essential, I think. And maybe back to Merry and Pippin, we can start our proper discussion of the two of them. I think that's the key that they bring. They bring that kind of hope and participation, importantly, participation in the kind of sovereign workings of the God who in Lord of the Rings is largely behind the scenes. But the hobbit's participation in his will and being an instrument in his hands to accomplish good and to accomplish the redemption of the world, Merry and Pippin specifically, I think, are the two hobbits who most centrally maybe bring that back to the other hobbits. And it's even literally shown in the fact that they physically grow, right? They encounter Treebeard and the Ents, and they drink the Ent draft, and they grow, and the hobbits see them when they come back, and they note how tall they are. And they're clearly these lordly hobbit figures now, who are coming back not only to help rule the Shire, but to help mature the people and be like fathers to the people and raise them up in their stature and in their wisdom.
Okay, I love it. Let me toss this question to you as a way of maybe springboarding off to other things. Why do you think Elrond opposes Pippin particularly coming? So there we are. We talked about this a little bit with Boromir, right? How do the different elements, how do the different members of the Fellowship come? And at the Council of Elrond, Elrond specifically says, like, I don't know about Pippin. Does he say the same thing about Merry? I don't remember.
Yeah, it's the two of them. I was just going to find that part.
And then this is referenced again. Like, Pippin brings it up again. Like, Elrond was against me coming. I'm ruining things. I don't belong here. So, first of all, why do you think Elrond says that they shouldn't come? Why does Gandalf take them anyways? And what is Tolkien doing by having Pippin bring that up again? Why do they need to be in the Fellowship?
Okay, here we go. This is a great question, and maybe there are things that we're going to have to leave unaddressed and undiscussed for the sake of time. But I want to read a couple of quotes here just because you're bringing up a particular part of the book that I already wanted to talk about, kind of adjacent ideas anyway, in the Council of Elrond. And so let me just read this first quote. Before they know that Frodo's going, before he chooses to go, and he volunteers, he's not elected or chosen or pushed to go, he alone is the first one to speak up and say that he's the second one. Bilbo says he would go. We've already mentioned that before. But Elrond says this. He says, "The road must be trod, but it will be very hard, and neither strength or wisdom will carry us far upon it. This quest may be attempted by the weak with as much hope as the strong. Yet such is oft the course of deeds that move the wheels of the world. Small hands do them because they must, while the eyes of the great are elsewhere." So that's right before Frodo volunteers to go. He makes this point that in some sense, this is not a matter of stature, right? He's alluding to, and I think Tolkien is alluding to, the fact that we need some divine providence here on our side, right? It's not just pick the strongest, pick the best. You can think about David being anointed king. He's not the strongest or biggest or best. He's the youngest, right? He's the one that's out watching the sheep. And Jesse doesn't even call him to be with the rest of his sons when Samuel is coming by, and he has to go get him, right? Because God doesn't merely look at the outward appearance, he looks at the heart. And I think that's the kind of idea that Tolkien, through Elrond, is getting at here, that it can be attempted by the weak with as much hope as the strong, which is maybe kind of incongruous with the fact that he opposes Merry and Pippin on the surface, although he does think that it's right that Frodo and Sam go. So after Frodo says he'll go, you know, Elrond says this, "If I understand aright all that I have heard, I think that this task is appointed for you, Frodo, and that if you do not find a way, no one will. This is the hour of the Shire folk, when they arise from their quiet fields to shake the towers and councils of the great. Who of all the wise could have foreseen it? Or if they are wise, why should they expect to know it until the hour has struck?" And I love that because it primes the pump, so to speak, for the beginning of the very next chapter, The Ring Goes South, which is when this discussion happens that you're alluding to. So Elrond is already acknowledging this quest can be attempted by the weak. In fact, he thinks it's right that Frodo goes, and he thinks that this is the hour of the Shire folk. In other words, this is the hour for the hobbits finally to take their place in the world and to participate in this kind of sovereign plan to overthrow the forces of darkness. And then I'll read just a brief portion of what you were alluding to. Let's see. So Elrond suggests that they need two more. They have seven. They need two more to send out against the nine riders to get to nine. But he says that he'll find maybe two of his own household, two of his sons, to send out with them. And in his mind, he's thinking the hobbits are already represented, right? The Shire folk is already, they and, you know, Gimli the dwarf, Legolas, one of the elves, and maybe we'll put in a couple more here, and then we have a couple of men. So all of the goodly peoples are represented in the quest already. But then Merry and Pippin come forward and say, but that will leave no place for us. We don't want to be left behind. We want to go with Frodo. And then Elrond says this. He has, I think, two reasons here. He says, that's because you do not understand and cannot imagine what lies ahead. Right? So his first reason, the first thing that he says, although it's not the only reason, is you don't understand what you're getting into. And you would be terrified. You would quake. You would shudder at the quest before you if you knew what was coming. And that's actually what comes up later when Pippin is talking about it. He says, at least this might not be what you were referencing, but at least one time in, I think, the Two Towers, Pippin says that Elrond was right. I would never have come, either Pippin or Merry, I would never have come if I had known what was going to happen to us, essentially. And there's just this beautiful kind of symmetry there of he's acknowledging the wisdom of Elrond, and yet it's also true that he's proving that Gandalf was right to defend him, because then Gandalf steps in, and I won't read the whole thing, but Gandalf steps in and unexpectedly, Tolkien says, supports Pippin. And he just says, Frodo doesn't know what's coming either. None of us know what's coming. And then Gandalf's point is I love this line. I will read this section. Gandalf says, but they would wish to go, or they would wish that they dared and be shamed and unhappy. I think, Elrond, that in this matter, it would be well to trust rather to their friendship than to great wisdom. And so Gandalf's point is, again, actually kind of cutting with the grain of what Elrond has already acknowledged, that the weak and the strong have the same kind of chance of pulling this thing off. And so rather than trying to put all of our ducks in a row and do the calculus perfectly so that we, you know, hit the nail on the head exactly, we should trust to their loyalty to Frodo and their willingness to die for him. And the faithfulness that they've already shown to this point in the quest, because they've fled from the Black Riders. They've gone through the Barrow-White's chamber in the Barrow Downs. They've lived through much with him, and they did that willingly. They took that on. So clearly they're loyal. They love him. They will do anything for him. And they have already said at the very beginning that they will perish with him if that's what it takes. So then finally, there is another reason that Elrond gives. He says, you speak gravely, but I am in doubt. So he's kind of doubting sending Merry and Pippin. And then he adds that the Shire is still in peril, and he had thought to send these two back as messengers to warn the people so that they can prepare as much as possible. And then he does say, as you alluded to earlier, I judge that the younger of these two, Peregrine Took, should remain. My heart is against his going. So he does add one final line in against Pippin. But the whole kind of gist of his argument is that the two of them he wants to send back to the Shire, which makes sense because the Shire ends up needing scouring and saving at the end. So I think ultimately Elrond is nervous that they won't endure, that he has doubt that they will endure, and he also legitimately does want to send them back as emissaries to the Shire to protect the Shire as much as possible because he anticipates the coming doom. The problem is that cuts against the story that Tolkien is trying to tell, which is that, yes, the Shire will need to be saved, and they need to go and mature, because if they stay and they're not changed by the journey, they won't be able to save it. They won't be able to lead the people and win the people, which is what has to happen. They have to display the kind of, you can think about it this way, I often have. They look at Aragorn and Gandalf and Elrond and Theoden and these others as titans in the realm of mortals who are opposing Sauron to his face, who are doing everything they can to stop him. And they have this kind of mimetic desire to imitate them and become like them. And if they don't encounter those titans and become like them, they can't come back and lead the people of the Shire in this kind of mimetic desire to become like Merry and Pippin. But that is what they do. They are changed, clearly, and even physically, and they come back, and the hobbits want to be like them. They recognize something true in them that has changed, that has kind of clicked into place, and they recognize, I need to be like that. It's not just I admire him. I need to be like him, and I need to be willing to fight against the darkness like he is, because to this point, at the Scouring of the Shire, when they get there, most of the hobbits have been happy to be enslaved. I say happy, that's tongue in cheek a little bit, but like they haven't resisted as they should have. And it's only on the arrival of the four hobbits after they've been changed that they get the kind of gumption to do what they need to do and get their house in order.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's an example of Elrond not seeing all ends, which actually ties with what you read at the beginning of that section, where like, yeah, even the very wise don't know exactly how this thing will happen, how this thing ought to happen. So that's good. Maybe moving into kind of keying off of what you were just talking about, in what ways specifically do you see the hobbits needing to mature? Both Merry and Pippin, but Merry and Pippin as representatives of the whole body of hobbits. Like, where do they need to change?
Yeah, there's so much there. So the first thing that I think we see very clearly, and you could maybe go a little bit earlier in the text for this kind of idea, but the first time it's explicitly stated, something like this is explicitly stated, is I think in the Barrow Downs, when Frodo is there and he's awake and he sees his three friends there, and there's this beautiful scene. I won't read it or go into it too much, but there's this beautiful scene, you know, of his courage being kindled in his heart. And Tolkien says, you know, in the heart of every hobbit, even the, I think he says the most timid and fattest hobbit, there's a seed of courage waiting for essentially some dire circumstance to awaken it and kindle it. And Frodo was neither very timid nor very fat. And so you see his courage is blossoming. He saves his friends rather than deserting them and trying to protect the ring, even by sacrificing his friends. So there's that kind of theme, I think, not just in Frodo, although it is seen very clearly in Frodo and Sam in particular. You have Shelob's lair later with Sam especially. But I think that's true of all the hobbits. I think that's one of the fundamental things, is having their courage to resist evil kindled, having their willingness to put up a fight and to lay down the farming implements, the shovels and the wheelbarrows, and to take up arms and defend themselves. And not only to defend themselves, but to defend others, which is so often what's happening. I mean, Frodo there is not gaining his courage to defend himself. He's gaining courage to defend his friends, even when it might cost him. Sam is the same way in Shelob's lair, defending Frodo while Frodo tries to get through the spider webs. Yeah, and Cirith Ungol. And then ultimately, that's what Merry and Pippin both do. Pippin with Faramir, particularly, and Merry with Theoden and Eowyn. So you see this kind of courage being kindled. I think that's the first thing my mind goes to. There's also this kind of understanding of the way that the world works that they just don't have at the beginning. And maybe Frodo more than the others, but Merry and Pippin definitely don't. They don't understand what life is like outside the Shire, and therefore they don't understand reality. They understand a very, very narrow kind of sliver of the real world. So in that way, they're sheltered. We might say, like, you shelter your kids growing up, but little by little, you take away the walls and you take away the kind of guardrails, and they become more and more exposed to the world. They need to be kind of cultivated to be able to deal with that well and to be able to enter into that world properly. That's our goal as parents, but it has to happen at some point. They can't just stay in that kind of incubation where you're protecting them. And the hobbits can't just stay in the incubation of the Shire where they're protected and safe. They have to go beyond that and not just rely on others, but actually participate in the world as God made it.
Yeah, you also see the love they have for one another needing to mature and develop. And you see that they have affection for one another based upon jolly old times, but then it needs to be tempered. It needs to be hardened. It needs to be brought into greater and greater relief. So there's this sense of like the seed of courage, there's a potentiality there. There's a desire that you know, to be faithful to one's friends. But that actually needs to be proven. So in some senses, the coming of age element is a proving of what's there, not necessarily a changing. Thoughts?
On that element in particular, proving is the right word, because the courage and other things like it, the wisdom, the understanding, those things, they're maybe there in potentiality in some kind of way, but they do need to come in greater form. They need to grow and develop. The love is there, I think, like you're alluding to, but it has to be proven. It has to be shown, right? That's why Merry and Pippin are willing to go. That's actually explicitly why Gandalf says they should go. He's trusting to the love that they already have for Frodo, that because they have this love, it will be proven over time. It will be proven on the journey, and it is. And that's absolutely wonderful. Yeah.
We've been talking about Merry and Pippin as a unit. I'd be interested in your thoughts on them separately, because they're not the same. Elrond distinguishes between the two of them. They have different tasks. They have different heroic feats they do. You know, one of them becomes associated with Gondor. The other becomes associated with the Mark. You've got parallels, but also differences. You know, Merry is the older. He's the more mature. He's takes the lead in the scouring of the Shire. So, thoughts on them as individuals? What do they each contribute? Do they change in the same ways? Do they change in different ways? What's up with that?
Yeah, this is a hard question for me to answer because the films loom so large in my mind. And in Peter Jackson's trilogy, they're inseparable. I mean, even when they're literally in separate places and there's only one of them on screen, they look so similar and they act and speak so similarly in their mannerisms that I can't help but see both of them at the same time in some ways. I mean, that's maybe overstating it to some degree, but really they are just so identified with one another. And the reason it's hard to separate that out in my mind is because in the books you get a lot from each of them as individuals, but it happens in such an interspersed way over a long period of time that it's hard to say, like, okay, here's Merry's arc, here's Pippin's arc. And you can kind of trace through the events, but I think you really have to dive deeply into the dialogue and what they say, how they respond in very particular ways to get at some of the depth of that question and give a real answer. So I guess there's probably more here than I'm ready to answer, and I'd be happy to hear your ideas too. But minimally, I do think there's a lot of overlap in their journeys through Rohan and Gondor. Obviously, it's somewhat different, but they do both go out to battle. They both swear fealty to a king. In some ways, maybe you might say there's this theme in Merry's story of embracing Theoden and Eowyn and Rohan in some ways as family, right? He looks to Theoden explicitly as a father, which means he sees Eowyn, I think, largely as a sister in some ways. And so he's fighting for his family. And Pippin, on the other hand, is submitting to Denethor, someone who I often defend as a good man who's been corrupted by grief and despair and deceit of the enemy. So I think Pippin sees his goodness and is willing to submit to it, even when he sees that Denethor is maybe not always acting wisely and he's kind of opposing Gandalf, and he's still willing to do his duty and act out of duty to Gondor, to Frodo, to Middle-earth as a whole, maybe, and to Denethor specifically, because Boromir sacrifices himself. So there's a lot more emphasis on Pippin doing his duty, and that's what leads him then to save Faramir. And then Merry is acting, I think, much more out of love than of duty. And in fact, that is emphasized again and again in his story with some of the dialogue.
I think that's really insightful. I've never looked at that in that way before, that what Merry does is he binds himself to people, right? And it's love for Theoden personally. And then he's connected to Eowyn personally. Whereas you don't get the sense really at all that Pippin is binding himself to Denethor personally. You get the sense that he's fulfilling a blood debt in some respects, that he's actually swearing fealty to Gondor, and he becomes a member of the Tower Guard. And you have emphasized, you know, with Beregond, you have this like rigid law that he is now connected to. So he's binding himself to an institution, whereas I think you're right, Merry is binding himself to a family. But you need both of those. That's really interesting. So Tolkien is highlighting both of those needs. You have to have strong institutions, but also strong family bonds as well. One point that just came to me is Pippin has to grow up more than Merry does. And so Pippin has to come out of Merry's shadow. And this is part of what going to Gondor does for Pippin. And then there's that poetic reversal in that it's Pippin who then goes and finds Merry and brings him back after he's, you know, struck the Witch King. But of course, what precedes that is the most fundamental difference between the two of them, which is the Palantir. Pippin goes for the Palantir and Merry doesn't, right? So it's hard to find, like, I was thinking about it, do they have a fatal flaw? Do they have a fundamental weakness that has to be overcome? And if so, it's got to be in the area of the Palantir. Because that's like one of the only places where you see Pippin transgress and then suffer punishment in a way. And he's got like this, his own mini arc there. But you see Merry staying steady in that. He doesn't go for the Palantir. He doesn't even seem tempted by it. So, questions. Do you think the Palantir incident is like actually a deep thing between Merry and Pippin, or am I reading too much there? And do you think that Pippin needs to grow up in ways that Merry doesn't? Thoughts on that?
I think that's true. I'd be interested to think a little bit more about Merry and what that might be for him, if there is something. But clearly in Pippin, there's a curiosity that has to die. And curiosity as a vice, not curiosity like, oh, this wanting to know more about the world and in a good way. That's how we use curiosity more now. But curiosity traditionally is a vice. You want to know for the sake of knowing. There's a reason that we say curiosity killed the cat. And in fact, even as I was looking at this scene from A Journey in the Dark when they're in Moria, I pulled it up in the book. And when he throws the rock down the well and Gandalf gets mad at him and he says, you know, throw yourself in next time and you'll be no further nuisance to us. Now be quiet. It starts by saying, I didn't remember this until I just read it. Pippin felt curiously attracted by the well. I think that's it explicitly. So it's his curiosity that gets him interested in the Palantir too. He wants to look. He wants to see. He has a desire to know for the sake of knowing, which is also maybe weird because there's this, I don't have enough kind of fresh on my mind to go into this in depth, but there's this kind of comment from Pippin when they're setting out from Rivendell and they're under the shadow of Moria and they're making their way around, and Pippin is asking if they're near Mordor yet because he doesn't understand the scope of the world. I think Gandalf kind of chastises him for it a little bit. And he says, like, didn't you look at any of the maps while we were in Rivendell? And he says, no, I didn't. Frodo goes in more for that sort of thing. Like, he's not concerned with the rest of the world and learning how big it is and learning lore, which is weird because he's curious. But then you do see, I think, even a maturing of that in Isengard after the overthrowing of Isengard. It's, and this may be reading too much into it, but Gandalf and the rest of the company come up. And when they ask where Treebeard is, Pippin throws out some weirdly specific name for part of Isengard, like a region of Isengard where Treebeard is, and sends them off that way. And okay, it piqued my interest when I read it a few weeks ago. Like, he just said a few weeks ago, I'm not really interested in the world and maps and things like that. And now he has this kind of deep knowledge of Isengard's geography and what the proper names for places are that he didn't have before. And so I think because he's, you know, spending time with Treebeard, he's learning to call things by their proper name, learning where things are, what they are, where they go, how they're to be used, that sort of stuff. Clearly, that's not totally there yet because then he has to encounter the Palantir. But even then, I think he's, you know, that's a greater kind of challenge in front of him, that he's suffering the consequences, like you said, but that also leads to and catalyzes his further growth in the story by going to Gondor.
Yeah, it's not hard to imagine students or children being like Pippin in that respect, of having this sort of insatiable curiosity, but it's not actually a desire for wisdom. It's not actually a desire for knowledge. It's just sort of this reflexive, I wonder, like what if sort of mode. What would happen if I did this? I don't know. Let's just do it. So that seems to be what's being rebuked in Pippin's character. And he needs to sober up. And the antidote for him is is that he gets knowledge. He gets to see. Like, okay, you want to look? Okay, you get to look. Now you've seen. And you don't like it very much. But now, actually, you also have to be drawn up into the halls of power now. You actually are now drawn up into the high chamber of Minas Tirith. And that's where you get to be. You're now in the halls of power. Okay? You wanted it. This is, okay, sometimes you get what you want. And now you have to live soberly.
That's incredible. I had not put two and two together here. But when he takes the Palantir, he sees, like you said, what the world is really like. He sees who Sauron is. He sees him face to face in some sense, and he's terrified. And so he now knows what he's fighting against, but also he's uniquely qualified to serve Gondor under Denethor, because Denethor also knows what Sauron is like because of the Palantir. And so, you know, it's him and it's Denethor and it's Aragorn eventually, but that's it, right? I mean, I guess Saruman, right? Saruman's been corrupted by the Palantir, but yeah, that's just a fun kind of little theme there with Pippin and Denethor, again, connecting them and their understanding of the enemy. And whereas Denethor responds with despair because he's been deceived by the enemy, Pippin has the kind of wisdom to recognize, I saw how horrible he is and how wicked he is, and yet I'm not losing my hope, right? I trust in Frodo and Sam. Again, because he loves them, he's connected to them. And so he can see what Denethor can't, which is that these are worthy hobbits going into the gates of death, so to speak, to try to save the world. And we're going to do what we can to help them here, right?
And what Pippin doesn't lose, but what has to mature, is the joviality, is the optimism, is the bounciness. So he has to be tempered. It has to be sobered. The vicious elements of that lightness, that levity, have to be removed. But he doesn't ever lose it. He's still cracking jokes to the end. And that's appropriate as well. And so you have that him coming face to face with the enemy leaves him still possessing hope, which is not the case for Denethor. So he's a foil for Denethor in that respect. So, okay, bringing it back to Dadcraft, maybe in hopes of landing the plane somewhat, the hobbits are children, to some extent, children who grow up. We, as dads reading Lord of the Rings, are putting ourselves in their shoes. Through their eyes, we see the story, etc. And so we encounter our own childlikeness, both positively and negatively. But also, if it's a coming-of-age story, how can this inform our parenting? How can this inform how we raise our children, how we think about our children, what we want to draw out of them? It seems like all of the things that we just brought up with Merry and Pippin are things that we could intentionally be trying to draw out of our children. So there's a seed of courage, right, planted in the chubbiest of toddlers. Okay, how do we draw out that courage? Okay, there's familial affection for father, for mother, for siblings. How do we prove it? How do we test it? How do we teach our children to bind themselves to people and to bind themselves to institutions rightly? How do we give them those sorts of opportunities to say, these are my people, I'm going to lay my life down for my people, even when they're seven? Like, what can that look like? Or what else do you see?
I think tied to that idea, because those things are all kind of disparate elements of one overarching theme, and I'm going to try to put words to it, and you can help me if you think of better words for it. Even in tying themselves to families and institutions, I think one of the central realizations of the hobbits is that there's more to life than what's in front of your face. And because, I mean, if you just think about the hobbits themselves, like, they love their families, they're tied to their families. They love their hobbit institutions and are tied to their hobbit institutions insofar as they have them, right? And their culture and their traditions and things like that. What they don't see is how they fit in the world and what their place is in the larger narrative. And that is essential for our kids to understand, that your life is not just about you, and it's not just about you and us as a family. And it's not just about you and us as a family and our local church. It's about your place in God's story as a whole. And that's what I want my kids to understand, because the other things will change. I'm going to die. They might move and join another local church, right? These realities that we're growing them up in are subject to change, and change dramatically, and change in an instant in some cases. And then their life looks totally different, for good or for ill, right? It could be a great tragedy, or it could be this incredible blessing, a new opportunity that presents itself. But either way, your life changes. You now have to find your way and orient yourself within the new context. Like, you can think about it almost like a literal book, right? You come to the end of book one and you turn the page and it says book two, right? And now there's a new part of the story. There's a new point that the author is getting at. And we want to teach our kids to be understanding themselves that way, as part of the story that God is telling, and ordering themselves rightly in that story, which is what I think the hobbits have to do. They have to order themselves rightly as a society and as individuals within the story.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's extremely insightful. Well done. Good job. That was great. And so what we as dads do then is we teach them the scriptures. We read them the stories of the Old Testament. We read them the stories of the New Testament. We cast this vision for them that they're on a grand quest, actually, right? The quest is for the celestial city, or the quest is for holiness, or the quest is battling darkness, or whatever it is. But Christ is your captain. You're part of a merry company. It is bigger than what it looks like. I think you're exactly right. That's gold.
Because that's what's going to give them vision. That's what's going to give them hope in dark times, and drive and mission in good times, and a kind of compass to steer them throughout their lives and help them to make decisions. And obviously all of those things can be given wrongly, or given in a misguided way that lead our children to miss the mark because of our instruction. So our hope and our reliance has to be on God and on His word. Like you said, we have to always be coming back to the fundamentals, the basic truths that He has outlined for us in Scripture, and make sure that we exposit those to our children and give them opportunities to live them out and to succeed, and praise the success and kind of encourage them in that. And when they fail, to break down the failure and talk about, okay, why did this happen, right? Why did you not act like David here? Why did you sin? You know, David faced a similar situation and he did the right thing here, and you chose not to. Let's talk about that. Like, what led to it? How can you be more like David? How can you be more like the Apostle Paul? How can you be more like Christ, right? Is the obvious example.
Yeah, and teaching them that these stories are our story. This is not actually separate. This is, you're a character in the same story David was a character in, right? He was a much more important character, but that's neither here nor there. It's the same story. Do the great tales never end, Sam says. Answer, no, they don't. They go on and on and on, right? But characters come and go in the telling. So kids, this is your part. Your part has come. All right. So play it well, and it's bigger than it looks like. Just like the hobbits need to leave the Shire, ultimately to return to the Shire. The point was not for them to not come back to the Shire, but they needed to understand the world rightly in order to be of service to the Shire.
Yeah, and I think the key there also, a key kind of principle to teach your kids and to try to get them to understand in a deep and abiding way, is that the things that look small change the world, right? Raising a family faithfully with your children and your wife, that changes the world over time. And those small deeds that you do, you want your kids to understand that the small deeds that you do have ramifications forever, in eternity. And now I'm wanting to quote Gladiator, right? Maximus says, what we do in this life echoes in eternity. And it's true. It's an incredibly Christian line, right? What you do in this life, you want your kids to understand, echoes in eternity. The story is, in one sense, bigger than you, maybe in every sense, bigger than you. And at the same time, your actions are part of the story and matter and have an effect on the story. And so don't think, well, it's way bigger than me, and so it doesn't matter what I do as a little hobbit in the Shire. No, it does. That's the whole point, right? It matters vitally what you do. And helping them to see that, you know, changing the world very rarely looks like being the Apostle Paul or Julius Caesar or Napoleon Bonaparte, right? It very often looks like, for almost everyone ever, having a family and trying to live as a godly man or woman, right? For our daughters, we want them to grow up and be godly women who walk faithfully with their Lord.
Amen. I think that's about right, sir. Let's wrap her up. What's your book recommendation for us today, sir?
So today, I am going to recommend the book Guards, Guards by Terry Pratchett. We haven't done any Pratchett, have we?
No, we haven't. Oh, man.
Here's the first of many by Terry Pratchett that we will recommend. Guards, Guards by Terry Pratchett. So he is a fantasy author. The only author I have found of fiction, at least, you know, contemporary author of fiction, that I would put in a similar kind of category to Tolkien, just in terms of his skill as a writer, his ability to understand human nature. I think Lewis gets at this very well with his characters as well, actually. He just doesn't have as much of the whole like world behind it and everything working all in sync like a giant grandfather clock. But he's like a really, really good wristwatch, right? I don't know if that makes sense at all to you, but Pratchett is like the grandfather clock with a million moving pieces. And then, you know, this line of dialogue comes in that reveals your soul to you. And he's not even a Christian, which is, you know, the fault that you can find in his stories. There are plenty of ideas that you say, well, that's repugnant and is not true, but there's so much good there that it so heavily outweighs those moments that it's like, okay, this is clearly Pratchett engaging in his kind of ideology and whatever he believed about the world. I don't even know, but he clearly wasn't a Christian. He's engaging in some ideology here that's taking him astray, but like 80% of the time he's hitting the nail on the head and he's just drilling down into the world and what it's like and human nature with his characters. So anyway, Guards, Guards specifically starts a series that goes, that goes through the story of the City Watch and kind of the rebuilding of the City Watch in a giant city of Ankh-Morpork, where there are so many delightful things that he comes up with. Like his ideas, he's so creative and so unique. Like the Assassin's Guild is part of the government and has like certain mandated things that they, you know, they have to pay this much to assassinate somebody, but it's like decreed by law.
If there's going to be crime, it might as well be organized crime.
That's right. You have to have a permit to be a thief and things like this. It's just fantastic, whimsical. It's comedic. I don't think I've ever read an author that's as funny as him, and I don't think it's close. I can't think of one. And so, yeah, I laugh my head off when I read Pratchett. So Guards, Guards by Terry Pratchett. But if you throw a dart and hit any of his 30, 40 Discworld books, it's going to be a riot.
It's kind of poetic, I think, that you're the first one to recommend Pratchett. I think that's great. Wholehearted agreement. For my money, Woodhouse is funnier, but that's it, you know, in some ways apples and oranges. Pratchett's a genius. Pratchett can be uniquely frustrating sometimes because of how close he gets. Maybe at some point I'll recommend his book Nation. But Nation, for the first 4/5 of it, I thought, this might be the best book I've ever read. And then the final 5th made it not that way. Like, oh, you asked all the questions. You asked all the questions! And then you didn't give the right answers, alas. Anyways, that's not my recommendation for today. My recommendation for today is an utterly different book. This is The Elements by Euclid, which is the fundamental geometry textbook for the West. And it's a book that you and I are both teaching through right now, which is kind of fun. And my experience teaching through it this last term, what I was surprised by was how delightfully accessible it actually is. So when I was first getting into it, when I was teaching high school geometry, I thought, let's give it a go. It'll be fun. And I was bewildered and the kids were bewildered, but that's because I lacked resolve. And now as I'm coming back to it and teaching it, admittedly, to college students, I've discovered, like, this is actually well within the purview of any intelligent person. So if you think of yourself as a remotely well-educated person, you would benefit from Euclid's Elements. Even just go through, just book one. It really gives you some insight into the nature of mathematics, the nature of mathematics as a human endeavor, axiomatic thinking in general. It sharpens you. It's quite lovely. If you give it a chance to breathe, it's quite lovely. So the Elements by Euclid.
You didn't mention this, but I will. You have to read it with a notebook on hand and a compass and a straight edge. You can't just read through it and expect to understand what's going on or to enjoy it. But if you actually sit there and work through the propositions on a blank sheet of paper without a ruler, just using the compass and straight edge, it's going to blow your mind some of the things that you can do with those two tools and almost no, things that you're assuming. There are five postulates and you just go to town. And there are also really helpful videos that can kind of summarize if you're missing steps, because he doesn't explain everything like step by step when he tells you to do something. If he's expecting you to use three other propositions you've already learned, he just expects that you know that. So I found, as I'm prepping it, oh, that's the step I'm missing. I see. There are helpful resources online that can make it more enjoyable too. So that's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us on the show today. I hope that you've enjoyed it. And if you'd like to support the show, we have a link to our Patreon in the show notes below. So that's a way that you can help us keep things going here and pay the bills, so to speak. We need to pay editors and hosting services and things like that. So we would love your support if the show has been a blessing to you in any way or been edifying. And even just a few bucks a month goes a long way to helping us cover costs. We also want to say thank you to Shane Caver for the use of our theme music and to ETC Media for editing the podcast. So you can find links to their work below as well. And they've been a great blessing to work with. With that, we hope you've been blessed and edified by the show.
Don't be hasty.
Actually, I didn't have the pleasure of teaching last week. I got sick and was throwing up.